morning. We are going to hear this morning two cases of the Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Willie Nunnery, 07AP1908D and 06AP1191D. Mr. Nunnery, I'm going to ask you to present both cases, and then I'm going to ask the OLR to do their response to both cases. Is that satisfactory? Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Nunnery.
May it please the court. I ask for the court's indulgence in my introductory comments first. I come here with a deep degree of humility, understanding the severity and magnitude of these allegations. The OLR seeks an obituary of my practice of law. And to me, that is a fundamental question. Do I possess the requisite moral character and integrity to continue the practice of law? That question I should be the one responding to. I want this court to understand something about Willie Nunnery. I am a product of the segregated era in the South. I entered and went to law for one specific reason, and that is to practice civil rights law. In this practice, I have been practicing before many courts. I have quietly published opinions, Billings versus Metropolitan School District, a finding that the Madison School District violated Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, 259 Federal 3rd 807. I've argued Blice versus the Interimium, the Seventh Circuit case, 409 Federal 3rd 861. I have appeared pro hac vici in the Southern District of Georgia, Tennessee, Texas, Louisiana. I finished at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Yet, I studied the bar to get my license in Louisiana, and I satisfactorily passed the bar. I've argued before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, U.S. Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, so I have practiced civil rights extensively. What has hurt me more than anything in this practice is that there is a belief by the OLR that fundamentally, I am a bumbling idiot out here practicing law and civil rights, and I don't know what I'm doing. I reject that wholeheartedly. I would also admit there have been two profound judicial decisions that have impacted me. The DPA disciplinary matter in 298 West 2nd, 289, and the sanctions in the federal court and the circuit court. And I understood this. In 289, this court indicated, we are not persuaded at paragraph 61.313 that Attorney Nunnery was, as he implies, merely a hapless victim of an unscrupulous client. And it went on further to say, he has violated by failing to examine files seeking to discover basis of legal sufficiency of allegations of parties on whom behalf one is signing a document. Well, in the civil rights arena, I have clients come to me and tell me A, B, and C. Prior to this disciplinary action, I used to take their word. Then, in the Jimenez matter, cited at 301, 306 in 298 West 2nd, I understood Then I also had the case of Harden versus S.C. Johnson, 167 Federal 3rd, 340, a published opinion case, which is also cited numerous times in the records in these proceedings. I have begun, after the disciplinary matter, to allow clients to look at Harden versus S.C. Johnson. And what troubles me is the impact of those cases. My background in public service is described in the record 732 to 734 of the transcript. 735 to 740 talks about my public record, what I've done, and the testimony. If the court will, when a client comes in on a civil rights matter, post-disciplinary proceedings, post-sanctioned by Judge Krabs, post-Seventh Circuit sanctions, when they come in now to me, I am asking the question, do I have a prima facie case of race discrimination? Are you part of a protected class? Have you suffered adversity? What is the action? In every case in this proceeding, whether it be Dobbins, Sproles, whether it be Galvan, whether it be Hart or Baskin, there are some complicated factual issues in these cases that the OLR has no fundamental knowledge about, nor did the referees have an appreciation for. Take, for example, in the complaint regarding Goodman, paragraphs 9, 11, and 12, 19. By letter dated December 29th, Nunnery requested some material from Southport. 11. Nunnery did not take further actions on Dobbins' HUD complaint. 19. Other than forwarding a July 15, 2011 to Southport, indicating his intent to add Southport, Nunnery did not take any further action. What are they saying? OLR is saying you were incompetent. When you look at the theory of the case, what was the theory of the case? The theory of the case was that Dobbins sought to buy property. The theory of the case, were they being manipulated because of their race or their standing? Did the bank get involved with manipulating them because of their race? That's the theory of the case. What did we do? They never asked that. What we did, we sought the records from Southport. I hired an investigator to look at all the other property-related managers' sales to see whether whites and blacks were treated alike. The answer to that was no. There is no prima facie case. The referees, no OLR, ever even thought about that. But yet, because I didn't do anything else, then I'm incompetent.
So, Counselor, if I understand you, you're saying you did nothing else because after you did a more complete evaluation of the claim of the person who'd come to you, you determined there was not a prima facie case, so you shouldn't do anything else. Is that what
you're saying? That's exactly what I'm saying. Take the Annie Sproles matter.
Did you advise your client?
Absolutely. But the other thing about that is this, Chief Justice. In this hearing, I posed the question in the Maxwell hearing. This is a splendid example. On pages, the Maxwell hearing, transcript volume 1, page 32. And what an attorney, Nunnery, told you that with respect to this case, there has to be an additional due diligence inquiry as to what happened in this case, didn't he? Ms. Falk, object to form. It's cross-examination. Ms. Falk, well, I don't know if the witness know what due diligence means. This is the intervening objection and the statement. What they're saying, this poor black woman is in here being asked a question. She doesn't know what due diligence means, and she needs help. What I was saying to the witness, look, I have to do a thorough due diligence as to what happened in your case. What else they didn't appreciate, the OLR. I have clients coming to me, can't pay money. After the Civil Rights Act of 1991, there is no need to go to the EEOC. So I have been utilizing the Equal Rights Division as a means of methods of trying to secure evidence in a case without paying anything. It was purely for discovery purposes. So, with respect to...
Counselor, in that regard, I know that there is an allegation that the ERD complaint was dismissed, and then there was a right to sue letter, which you don't get until the ERD complaint is dismissed. So you could have taken that case to federal court when you got the right to sue letter. Did you not take it, and tell me why?
And that is the confusion, Chief Justice. Not only I could have gone to the federal court under 42 U.S.C. 1981, okay, paren A and B, without even going to the ERD.
Right.
I could have gone to the federal court from day one, because the Civil Rights Act of 42 U.S.C. 1991 amendments follows the same analytical model as Title VII. Then, in the proceedings...
Mr. Donnelly, let me interrupt you for a minute, if I might. There's 36 counts here in the two cases. How many of these counts are you actually contesting? Because I know you've admitted to several of them.
What I am contesting is, are these cases on competency, due diligence, and investigation with respect to the all of the employment-related cases.
Does that relate to half of the counts charged against you, or how many of the counts?
I don't know how many counts it is. I will tell you with respect to the conflict of the communications, the conflict of interest, prohibited transactions, investigation that I didn't do a thorough investigation. I believe that those are totally without merit. And what I'm asking this court for, and I know time is of the essence, what I'm asking this court for, please, make a decision on me based on a rational basis, not a subjective criteria, not feeling sorry for litigants who come here. And to the esteemed justices, let's take, for example, the theory of the Maxwell case, transcript pages 547, 549. She was alleged in race discrimination because a white managerial coordinator had a credit card and a cell phone. She was the purchasing coordinator. 547 to 549. She had no cell phone. She was saying that, look, I'm being discriminated against because of my race. Once one goes to that inquiry, they were not similarly situated. They did not have the same title or function. That is simply not a race discrimination case. The other thing that bothers me, in the record, I go ahead and subpoena manpower. Why did I subpoena manpower? I subpoenaed manpower to find out whether Ms. Maxwell had inadvertently been bad-mouthed in trying to get other employment.
Counsel, in that case, in the Maxwell case, the allegation in part is that you just didn't keep your client informed, that you dismissed the ERD action after filing the appeal without telling your client or getting your client's permission, and it was about 2 years later, if I recall correctly, after the case was dismissed, that your client was advised. Is that correct or incorrect?
I disagree with the total characterization of that, Justice Bradley. The point of the matter is, I'm in tune with her. She knows I've done the subpoena on Manpower. She knows what I'm doing. She is just upset that she hasn't gotten any money. I've told her she doesn't have a case. No, I didn't write her a letter. She did not have a case. But what they do in OLR, and they have never shown me this, what evidence did I miss? What harm was caused to her? And the reason for the Manpower analysis as I go forward, I'm really trying to reach over. There was a Supreme Court case, Robinson versus Shell Oil, which held that a discriminatee, even though they were not still employed, if they had been bad-mouthed in letters of recommendation on subsequent cases, that would lead to a retaliation claim. And you can go on. The whole Baskin versus Hart matter. That case was predicated on a very novel theory. Mr. Baskin was a white man. He had sought to protect or aid Mr. Hart. And the question at that time, if an adverse employment action had been taken against Mr. Baskin, the white man, did 42 U.S.C. 1981 apply? That was unsettled law. So when that case goes forward, the Seventh Circuit says no, the Supreme Court has subsequently overturned it. Hart was a published opinion. In addition,
in the Hart case, it's alleged that you missed deadlines, that you didn't respond to a motion for summary judgment, and that a few days before the brief was to be filed in the Seventh Circuit, that you moved to withdraw from the case so that the client had to argue it.
The record on that is completely convoluted and confusing. One, the Seventh Circuit has a Seventh Circuit settlement conference. There was a telephonic call with Mr. Hart, Mr. Baskin, Mr. Stagner. The employer was about to make an offer. Mr. Hart is angry now. I don't want you having any money. You're threatening me to take a settlement. I file an affidavit with the Seventh Circuit asking to withdraw. All of that is in the record. The Seventh Circuit gave Mr. Hart ample time to file his pleadings. The withdrawal came pursuant to the settlement negotiations. The summary judgment was filed. Then they come back and think about this. You were incompetent in the Hart matter. Hart goes and appears pro se, gets a reversal on the summary judgment decision. The same summary judgment decision I file. Why is he getting a reversal? He's getting a reversal under Rule 56E because of all of the filings I made. So the de novo review was based upon evidence that I did. They also chastised me as OLR. You did no depositions. But what did I do? I got affidavits of all of the white workers, similarly situated to Hart, filed in the summer judgment. Went to Racine, got notarized affidavits. And strategically sometime, it is not necessary to just go and do depositions to rebut summary judgment. But the kicker in the case, the theory of Mr. Hart case, I have been discriminated against in overtime. When the interrogatories and materials came in, it showed that Mr. Hart had more overtime in some cases than whites. And the amount of overtime was so de minimis. What is that doing to the damage of his case? You are entitled to a make-whole remedy, reinstatement, back pay, etc. But I will say this to this court. No one has done an analytical in-depth analysis of the prima facie case in these matters versus what I did. It's easy to say you didn't add Southport to this case. Then the primary defendants in the Dobbins matter, he files bankruptcy.
Mr. Nunnery, if I understand the gist of your argument, does it boil down to something along the lines of no harm, no foul? In other words, if the clients learned later of the dismissal or if the clients learned later of these actions, you're indicating that OLR is unable to indicate any substantive detriment that they suffered as a result of that.
But I'm also indicating just
wait a minute, Mr. Nunnery.
Yes.
Does that accurately sum up what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
And moreover, just as Ms. Falk is objecting on me using the word due diligence to one of the witnesses, she don't know what that means. I'm dealing with people. I'm trying to explain summary judgment principle. I'm trying to explain principles of a prima facie case. I'm trying to explain why we don't have a case or why we do have a case. That's what I was trying to do. And at the end of the day, so what did I do? And I bring up the Jimenez matter and their last disciplinary matter.
Counselor, I want to, because your time is running, I want to talk to you about one other thing, which is the one that bothers me most, which is the matters involving the estate of John Davis.
And in the estate of John Davis, I have indicated on the record, in this case, I made an error. I indicated that I was wrong.
So are you not contesting any of the findings that underlie the John Davis decision?
What I am contesting is this. What I did pre-OLR investigation and inquiry. On page 807, before Mr. Flesch, I made a personal visit to Ms. Sadie Lois Davis in Memphis. I made a personal visit on page 808 to Mr. Davey Davis. I profusely apologized to them on the mishandling of this.
Well, what I'm more interested in is, are you objecting to the findings of the referee relative to that disciplinary, the facts arising out of that disciplinary action?
No, I am not objecting.
Okay, that's really all I'm interested in.
What I want to make clear on...
Well, I have one other thing. Your practice in equal rights areas is well known to me, both personally and through what I have read. But I was not aware that you were a probate lawyer, sir.
And that's... I was wrong. I admitted to that. I should not have ever been involved with that. And what I did after my mother's death, I came back here. I proceeded to get aid and assistance from the Hurley Burge, Ms. Stanton's firm. And I also indicated in the record I went to speak to the other attorney, the criminal lawyer.
So this is not an area that you practiced in on any...
Right.
Did you ever do an estate before the Davis estate?
No, nothing of this magnitude.
Okay, thank you.
That's counts 1 through 7, I think, that you don't dispute the referee's findings. As I recall, you then have repaid the beneficiaries maybe but for about $1,300.
I did not do anything to this case after the referee's decision, awaiting a full disposition. I am prepared to do whatever I have to do, but I didn't do anything subsequent.
Counsel, when you answered my question of whether you had practiced in probate arena before, you said you had done nothing of that magnitude. To me, that's kind of a qualified answer. And what I was trying to figure out is, what is your level of experience in probate court? Was this the first estate you've ever probated?
That this was the first one. I think I may have been there as a special administrator on a small or minor matter, but nothing of this involved.
Okay.
Now, I will say this to the court. With respect to a number of 1983 matters, 42 U.S.C. 1983 matters, whereby inmates have died in prison, there have been some residual probate matters whereby that had to be done. In one case I can recall in the federal court, the estate of Cotton,
the Michael Bess and Friedrich firm handled the probate-related portions of that. The decedent had children, etc. So, no, I...
You didn't do the probate of kind.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
There's been in the state of Myers another jail death case, and the estate of... I'm sorry, the estate of Kelvin Jackson is the one that the inmate died in the Green Bay Correction. That's the one Michael Bess and Friedrich did. I think my 25 minutes is...
You've got a few more minutes, Mr. Nunnery.
Mr. Nunnery, can you just conclude by telling me what it is you want from this court?
I believe that I have suffered enormously. And I really did not want to say this. This whole OLR structure, to me, did not ever attempt to help me. My attorney tried to have a sit-down meeting with the director to resolve this. That was a recommendation of time to be suspended that she had authority to do. They would not even want to meet with me. And what they have done, and for me, I am a practicing, I'm a licensed lawyer from Louisiana. I'm going to suffer reciprocity considerations. I am going to suffer more than normal because of this. They have OLR saying, you are a damn stupid ass lawyer. Forgive me. And we don't want you back out here. But on the civil rights front, and what I know, I believe that they have no fundamental understanding of civil rights. And if you look in the compendiums of all of the documents of OLR and the disciplinary cases, you're not finding disciplinary cases on the handling of civil rights case. There is no appreciation for what the real world civil rights is. There is just none. I'm dealing with people who have not finished high school, people who are aggrieved, people who do not understand subjective criterion versus objective criterion. One can come in and say, I feel I've been discriminated against. But the case law is so clear, it's objective criteria. And you taught me, in the disciplinary matter 298, no, I don't take their words anymore. I try to explore Southport. I try to explore and find direct evidence to stay in court. And I have, and it is noteworthy that the disciplinary matter, the matters of Hart, Baskin, Sproles, Maxwell, all occurred during the same relevant time period. One other point I want to drive home. With respect to the Sproles matter, she testifies, I never wanted to go to work again anyway. That's her testimony. She is being terminated for the Postal Service. She hires me to get her job back. They issue a notice of rescission, the administrative law judge. What does OLR say? You are incompetent, Nunnery. You didn't get a final settlement agreement to get her job back. You are incompetent, Nunnery, because you didn't see that she got all of her benefits. That's my incompetency. Yet, on a telephonic call, the administrative law judge, Ms. Mixon, the postal attorney, we all agree she's getting her job back. She testifies in this record.
Can I just interrupt? So I hear what you're saying. You're saying there's a fundamental disconnect between OLR's understanding of civil rights law and what you did. Are you saying that no sanctions should be imposed? I'm trying to figure out what the figure is or number is or what it is you're asking.
I don't want to get into that. And I've been asking this question. Do you really believe African-American clients and civil rights and the ethics laws apply. I think they all apply. But what I do not understand is that these decisions ought to be objectively based. The scope of representation in the Sproles matter was to get her job back. She gets an order to get her job back. Then later on, she gets an order, she's going AWOL. I tell her under the employment law, if you go AWOL, ma'am, they have a right to terminate you. In fact, she doesn't want to go back to work anyway. But she talks about how her parent, her mother was ill and that sort of thing. Look what kind of box I'm in. She done paid $750 for this. She said, I'll pay you more. I said, I'm going to take $10,000 from you. I have done what you asked me. I have gotten your job back. Then she says she doesn't know about a withdrawal of an appeal. Well, all of those documents were circulated to her immediately from the Merit System Protection Board. And what OLR says, as it relates to Southport Bank, you didn't do this, that's incompetent. You didn't do this for Sproles, that's incompetent. You didn't say this to them, that's a failure to communicate. She got her job back. And to get all sidetracked about the heart and basket matter of similar circumstances. Similar circumstances.
Are you asking that this be dismissed? Is that your, I'm just trying to figure out what your request is.
I will abide by whatever this court says, but I do believe this. Through this whole process and the one that the late Dan Hildebrand handled for me, what has happened to me, and those were all civil rights. I understood I made some communications errors. I'm a sole practitioner. I can tell these folks this till they're blue in the face. But the net effect on all of these cases, I worked over and beyond the call of duty. $1,500 in Dobbins, $750. In Sproles. Maxwell, $750. She gets all of her money back because she thought I had mistreated her. She had no case. Then they come here to the third tribunal, the OLR. You now help us. This is just wrong.
Mr. Nunnery, I'm going to ask Justice Siegel's question somewhat differently. In one of these matters, the recommendation is 6-month suspension. That's in one of the cases. In the other case, the recommendation is 2 years, and the OLR is seeking revocation, which is at a minimum 5 years. What discipline do you think you should get, if any?
I believe that the case under the Sheehan case at 224 was 44, and the Crumback case 286 was second. I believe that all of this stuff ought to be looked in the totality of the circumstances. With respect to Ms. Stanton, there were discussions underway to have all of this resolved for 12 to 18 months. That's where they were then. In terms of what the totality of these cases, I should be disciplined.
You should not.
I should be.
You should be, okay.
I have said that. I've said all that in my brief. But what I'm saying, pardon me.
And what do you think your discipline should be?
Somewhere, Your Honor, between 12 and 18 months.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nunnery. Julie Falk, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Please support. My name is Julie Falk, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this disciplinary proceedings. It's always an honor to appear before this court in attorney discipline matters. We are not here today because the OLR is alleging that Mr. Munnery engaged in incompetent representation. We are only alleging incompetent representation with regard to the Sprawls matter. We are not here today to fight for disgruntled litigants that have come to our office that are unhappy with the services that Mr. Munnery has provided. We are not here today because Mr. Munnery failed to provide a Cadillac representation to his clients. We are here today because Mr. Munnery engaged in serious misconduct, breaching his fundamental fiduciary duties to his clients on multiple occasions by converting client funds, failing to diligently and competently represent his clients' interests, failing to communicate with his clients concerning the status of their cases, failing to allow his clients to make informed decisions with regards to their cases, making misrepresentations to the courts, and making misrepresentations to the OLR and failing to cooperate with the OLR in its investigation of these matters.
Counselor, is the conversion of client funds limited to the probate matter?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
The OLR does appreciate this court combining the 2006 and 2007 cases for oral argument because although they are two separate cases, they exhibit a continuing pattern of misconduct involving 36 counts of alleged misconduct against Mr. Munnery. In addition, a disciplinary complaint was just filed in March of 2009, alleging 17 counts of misconduct. The OLR is requesting that this court issue one report for both cases and recommends that Mr. Munnery's license be revoked. In order to overturn the referee's decision in these cases, this court must determine that the referee's findings of fact were clearly erroneous. Conclusions of law are to be reviewed de novo. This court does not give great weight to a referee's sanction recommendation. Mr. Munnery has been previously sanctioned by this court. A previous disciplinary case was filed in September of 2004. In January of 2007, this court suspended Mr. Munnery's license to practice law in Wisconsin for 60 days for 12 counts of misconduct, spanning over a period from 1997 to 2003. This court found that he failed to reduce the contingency fee in writing, failed to hold a client's property in trust, failed to act with reasonable diligence and promptness, failed to keep his clients reasonably informed about the status of their cases, failed to allow his clients to make informed decisions with regards to their cases.
Ms. Falk?
Yes, yeah.
As I listened to Mr. Munnery, I heard him say what he did was investigate carefully his clients' matters. Some he found wanting. In that, at least in some of these instances, you got a client who thinks she or he should have gotten funds or some relief and doesn't because the case isn't worthy. And that clients tend to blame the lawyer rather than just blame the facts. How do you feel about that? Maybe you didn't hear that defense.
Yes, I did, Your Honor. Your Honor, this case isn't about whether or not his clients had viable claims. This case is about Mr. Munnery's failure to communicate to his clients in a timely manner the viability of these clients' claims. If Mr. Munnery had determined that his clients did not have a viable claim, he should have informed them and stopped the lawsuit. Instead, he drug his clients through needless litigation for years. For example, with regards to the Dobbins matter, the Dobbins hired him in the year 2000 to file a claim against Property Partners, Mr. Goodwin, and Southport Bank. He did not inform them until 2005, 5 years later, that he did not believe his clients had a valid claim. We're talking about...
Did you look at these claims to see if they had any merit? aside from the communication problems, which I understand exactly what you're saying, did you look at these claims to see if they had merit?
I don't know what exactly was done in the investigation because I was not involved in the investigative part of this case, but I do not believe that we did a thorough investigation into the validity of the claims. Just the facts that Mr. Nunnery drugged these clients through the cases, failed to communicate with these clients, and finally, in the end, notified them that he didn't feel that they had viable claims.
Okay.
In court.
Yeah, I've been looking back at the findings because I didn't remember there being anything in the findings about whether the claims are meritorious, so he goofed up and these people should have had their day in court and they didn't get their day. And that's what he's basically saying, that this, he served a group of people that always thought they had a claim. Initially, he used to just go with that, and then he got slapped for doing that. So now he's doing an investigation, and he feels like he's getting slapped when he does an investigation and nothing shows up. And so I was looking to see, did anybody look at the merits of these claims? Was there any showing that there was a prima facie case here that should have gone forward but did not? And I didn't find anything, but I thought, you know, the record probably better than I do.
No, the record does not indicate that there was a prima facie case and he should have moved on with the case.
Thank you.
Ms. Falk, did he inform his clients that they had no case in Dobbins before or after the matter was administratively closed for lack of action?
It was after the case was administratively closed.
And when your office contacted him regarding that case, what did he advise your office was the reason for the closure of that case?
With regards to the Dobbins matter, in the Dobbins matter, he did not indicate why he did not, in fact, pursue Southport Bank. Property Partners, one of the clients, was actually dismissed from the matter. We do not know the reason for why, in fact, Property Partners was dismissed. Mr. Goodwin filed for bankruptcy, and then Southport Bank, the only investigation Mr. Nunnery did with regard to Southport Bank was to write one letter to the president of Southport
Bank. Ms. Falk, didn't finding 19 indicate that Attorney Nunnery stated that HUD had not found probable cause of discrimination when your office contacted him? Was that, I read that as indicating that was the reason that he offered your office rather than it was administratively closed.
Okay, you're referring to the HUD matter that occurred before the federal complaint was filed?
Because
there was the HUD matter that was filed. That, with regard to the HUD matter, that case was administratively closed due to the Mr. Nunnery's failure to respond in that case. That there was no finding. He had informed our office that there was a finding of no probable cause.
Was that
was
accurate?
The case.
Was that accurate? Was that accurate, what he told you?
That was not accurate, what he told us. The case was dismissed due to a failure of the plaintiff or petitioner in that matter to pursue the matter. It was not a matter of that case being of the ARD finding no probable cause in that matter.
Ms. Falk, one of the things that I'm concerned about, probably I'm concerned about this more than anything, are the allegations having to do with conversion of funds. And I understand that that took place in the Davis probate matter. Could you explain to us what conversion is alleged here and was found by the referee?
Yes, Justice Crooks. The conversion that was found here was that Mr. Nunnery converted approximately $30,450.48. He converted these funds from the estate during the pendency of when the estate matter was open, when he was an administrator of the estate. The only reason that the court commissioner determined that this money was converted is because the court commissioner asked after Mr. Montgomery was removed as special administrator for him to file an interim report with the court regarding the sale proceeds from the house. Once Mr. Montgomery was forced to do that, he had to acknowledge that there were still funds owing to the beneficiaries with regard to the case, and he deposited $29,149.92 with the clerk of court's office. At this point, he still owes $1,300.56 that has not been reimbursed to the estate's heirs. He also still has retained an antique sofa that he reupholstered for, I believe, approximately $1,600 from the estate funds, and some silverware that he has still retained from the estate.
The $2,900 paid into the clerk's office, was that about 7 years after he obtained it? It seemed to me there was a long time that he had the monies.
There was a significant period of time. He began the probate. The probate was drug along, and then it wasn't, I can give you exact dates if you like.
Just so the record is clear, we're talking about 29,000, not 2,900, isn't that right?
29,000, yes, Your Honor. See, it looks like in August of 2000, he filed an application for informal administration, and then it was not until April 21st, 2006, that he deposited the balance of the estate with the clerk of court's office.
Ms. Falk, one matter of concern that Mr. Nunnery, it's of concern to me, it's more of a procedural matter. He indicated that either he or his attorney or both had requested a meeting, I think he said, with the director of OLR to talk about resolving this case, and that your office was not interested in having such a meeting. Would you like to respond to that? Are you in a position to do that?
I'm not privy to any information as to Mr. Nunnery and his attorney requesting to meet with our office. They may have requested to meet with the director. However, under normal circumstances, as long as we have the case that's gone through the PRC and found cause to proceed with regard to these matters, and the director has made his recommendation for sanction, we are not allowed to plea bargain with any of the respondents in these cases, so there would not be much we could have done if he would have met with us in our office to resolve the matter.
Might have gotten a stipulation.
Pardon?
He might have gotten a stipulation.
I don't believe it's possible that we could have gotten a 2212 stipulation with regard to the complaint or stipulation in the beginning of the matter. I'm not aware of any negotiations with regards to a stipulation in this case.
If this court, you communicate with the respondent before, during the investigation time period?
Our investigators communicate with the respondents during the investigation of the matters, that is correct. But the attorneys in our office would not get involved until after it has gone through the PRC. If this court looks at this case, you have different names and faces, but each of Nunnery's clients, except for and excluding the estate matter, have the same story. You have a vulnerable victim coming to Mr. Nunnery for representation involving a discrimination claim. Mr. Nunnery takes a flat fee from these clients, fails to explain what the flat fee is for, and agrees to represent the clients on a contingency fee basis. Nunnery fails to explain to his clients the legal theories upon which he is pursuing the cases or the viability of these cases with his clients.
Do you think his clients would be able to understand the legal theories that underlie an equal rights claim?
I don't think that they would understand in highly technical legal terms, but I believe that he could have explained, at least in layman's terms, what type of cases he was bringing against the defendants in the action.
But don't they all think they have a claim? I mean, that's why they came to him. Somebody discriminated against me because of my race, or because of my age, or because I'm a woman. So they come in believing they have a claim in street parlance. And it's his job to evaluate that under the legal standards and determine whether or not there's any merit to that. But doing so, is don't you think that's fairly technical work?
Well, it's technical work, but he can explain to them in layman's terms what he needs to prove. And in these instances, even if they believe they have a viable claim, Mr. Nunnery did not, at the outset of the case, do the requisite investigation into the matter to determine whether or not these clients even had viable claims, nor did he inform the clients that they did not have viable claims.
Well, you know, on a $750 retainer, you can do no discovery. You can't pay the court reporter on that for a half a day of a transcript and the work that it would take for a court reporter to appear. So the fact that he did no discovery by way of depositions, I don't find very persuasive. I mean, he got affidavits, which causes him to run around and use up his time, but he doesn't incur a debt to a third party. I mean, these are people that don't have $700 for a day of depositions and transcripts. And, you know, he's charging them $750 to do the whole thing as a flat fee. I don't know, what did you expect him to do aside from getting affidavits? I'm not persuaded that he should have been doing depositions, frankly.
Well, first off, in not all of the cases did he only require $750 retainer. I believe in Dobbins he
was $1,500.
Mr. Galvin, I believe, gave him $3,000. And he agreed to take these cases on a contingency fee basis. I mean, he has to do the requisite work in order to follow up and determine whether or not his clients have claims. He just can't sit back for 5 years and not do anything and then finally send his clients a letter indicating that they don't have a viable claim.
Well, you know, in Maxwell, he did an ERD case, okay? And it came back no probable cause. Well, I mean, no cause to believe that there was reason to proceed. When you get that kind of finding in an ERD claim, they presume that anything they can find shows discrimination, any factual thing. That's the standard that they apply. So when they come back and say, with everything before us, we can't say there's any discrimination, I mean, that's a pretty strong message, right? I mean, you get a right to sue letter out of that, but if you're going to take it to federal court, you better have something to stand on.
Correct, but the problem with Maxwell is that Mr. Nunnery never informed his client that they received a finding no probable cause and what exactly that meant for her case.
How long was it before he advised the client in Maxwell that the case had been dismissed?
In Maxwell, she received a document indicating that there was, I believe, a right to sue letter, and we told her not to worry about it. Then he did not inform her that he was dismissing her case ever. And the only reason that Ms. Maxwell found out that her case was dismissed is by talking to one of her professors at her school. Mr. Nunnery never informed her that she didn't have a case, never informed her that her case was dismissed. It was Ms. Maxwell hired Mr. Nunnery in approximately 2003. In 2004, she received the right to sue letter. Mr. Nunnery responded, advising her not to worry about the letter. He would take care of it. And then in 2005, she was advised by her professor at the University of Phoenix that he looked up her case and determined that the case was dismissed and that the statute of limitations, in his opinion, had expired for those cases.
Saying the statute of limitations has expired is troublesome, but it's only troublesome if someone looked at the case to see if there was a prima facie case to bring into federal court. I mean, you wouldn't want him to file it before the statute of limitations ran without a belief there was a prima facie case, right? That's what he got disciplined for the last time. So if you're going to rely on that as a finding against him, that the statute of limitations had run, it seems to me it's only fair to look at whether a claim should have been filed.
Well, if her claim should not have been filed, then Mr. Nunnery had a duty to tell his client
I don't quarrel with you about that, that he had a duty to communicate with his client.
Right, and he could have told her then to go to additional counsel for a second opinion and could have informed her when the statute of limitations would have expired in that case.
So
he failed to do so.
Help me out. Are you saying twofold? One, he should have worked these cases up differently, and secondly, he should have communicated better with his clients. Is that what you're saying? There are two problems with what he did with these cases. One, he didn't work them up. Two, he didn't have good communication skills.
He failed to have good communication with his clients. He failed to inform them as to what was going on with the cases. There were a lot of matters that were dismissed during the cases.
But are you saying that, I understand that part. That's pretty clear. And I don't disagree with you, probably. I'm wondering more about the working up the cases. You seem to hang your hat on, you should have done depositions. Justice Rogenczak, you know, puts forth some pretty basic reasons why someone would not be able to do that. He did do other things. Are you saying that he should have worked these cases up differently? And if so, how can you say that if you don't know whether these cases have any merit?
We're not specifically alleging that he had to work these cases up. What we are alleging is that he knew at some point in time that the cases did lack merit, that there were motions for dismissal, motions for summary judgment, that he should have informed his clients of that these motions were out there and what the ramifications of those motions were.
Do you have anything to suggest that these cases did have merit?
We did not, as I've indicated earlier to Justice Rogenczak, we did not do an investigation as to the merit of the claims.
Okay, so do you dispute what he says in that regard? I'm trying to figure out where the rub is here. Do you agree or disagree that the cases didn't have merit?
I don't have enough information to inform this court whether or not the cases, in fact, had merit.
Okay.
These are counts 8 through 10 in the Maxwell case, right? What are those counts?
Counts 8 through 10 in the Maxwell case?
Mm-hmm.
I believe one of them is failing to communicate with Ms. Maxwell, 1.4B.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1.4A. 1.4B for failing to communicate with Ms. Maxwell that the case was dismissed and allow her to make a decision as to how she wanted to proceed with that case.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, with regard to Ms. Maxwell's claims,
I don't have a complaint in front of me. That's why I asked. I know the numbers are 8 through 10. But I just don't
the
know.
Complaint is 76 through.
A 1.2A by withdrawing and dismissing her ERD case without discussing with that, that with her first. I believe that those are all the allegations.
Okay, so those are all really failure to communicate. They're not diligence claims. They're not uncovering the basis or the vitality or validity of the claim. It's just those counts, 8 through 10, as you've at least indicated now, are essentially failure to communicate or keep your client advised.
That is correct.
That's what he's
being sought discipline for. Is that,
that's correct. In the majority of these cases, it is failing to keep his clients apprised of the status of the cases. There's multiple instances where his clients have attempted to contact him. He failed to return their calls. When they have contacted him, he's indicated to them, sometimes in an abrupt manner, that the cases were rolling or moving along, and failed to inform them of significant developments in the case. I believe in one instance, for example, with Mr. Galvin, he had called him during a time when a motion for summary judgment was pending, and Mr. Nunnery informed him that the case was moving along and that there was nothing to worry about.
Ms. Falk, your time is running down. My understanding is, on behalf of OLR, you're asking for revocation of the license to practice law. Do you want to explain to us why you're asking for revocation?
Yes, Justice. The reason that the OLR is requesting revocation is due to the significant seriousness of Mr. Nunnery's failure to comply with his fiduciary duties to his clients. He has engaged in a serious pattern of misconduct where he's failed to communicate with his clients, failed to diligently pursue his clients' cases, he's made misrepresentations to clients, he's made misrepresentations to the OLR, he's made misrepresentations to the court during some of these proceedings. It's obvious that the 60-day suspension of Mr. Nunnery's license has not impressed upon him the need to stop engaging in this type of misconduct. And I do note that Referee Ferguson did recommend a 2-year suspension. However, Referee Ferguson, when he made that recommendation, did not have the benefit of the 2006 disciplinary proceeding against Mr. Nunnery in front of him, in which Referee Rosemary Barron recommended a 6-month license suspension. And also, the OLR believes that it is very serious that Mr. Nunnery has converted funds from the estate in the amount of $30,000. If you look at the...
Has any of that been repaid?
Has any of it been repaid?
$1,000
$29,000 of it has been repaid. However, it's the OLR's position that we do not know whether or not that money would have been ever repaid if the court commissioner in that case had not required Mr. Nunnery to file an interim report with the court to account for all the funds from the sale of the house. And to date, he still has not yet refunded the remaining amounts due, which is about $1,300.
Could I ask you, you spoke about misrepresentations, repeated misrepresentations. In your opinion, has Mr. Nunnery misrepresented anything to the court this morning?
Nothing that has struck my mind or that has come to my attention with regard to a misrepresentation this morning, no. But with regard to the Wiedholm case, this is a case where there was a previous public reprimand. Mr. Wiedholm converted $14,000, and this court held that by this misconduct, Attorney Wiedholm has demonstrated that he is unfit to represent others in our legal system. He has repeatedly breached the lawyer's fundamental duties to diligently pursue his client's interests and to protect property belonging to the client that comes into his possession. By converting to his own use funds belonging to a minor for whom he had been appointed guardian ad litem in a court proceeding, he placed his own personal pecuniary interest above the interest of his client. Moreover, this is not the first occasion we have had to discipline Attorney Wiedholm for professional misconduct. The totality of his misconduct considered in this proceeding warrants the revocation of his license to practice law. The same theory was also stated by this court in the Marcia Wright case, in which this court, in which Ms. Wright received a revocation for converting $11,000, this court emphasized that this court determines that the recommended discipline should be imposed here. The seriousness of attorney Wright's misconduct in using her professional position to take for herself money belonging to a client warrants the most severe discipline, license revocation. I see that my time is up. Are there any more questions from the court?
Thank you, Ms. Bork. Mr. Nunnery, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. This, and I'll respond briefly. I asked this court, how many times have there been disciplinary actions taken against lawyers who have filed Rule 12b-6 motions, ineffective assistance of counsel? What has this court done? What has OLR done in that regard? Furthermore, she indicates to you that I did not communicate with Ms. Maxwell about the dismissal of her ERD complaint. Anyone knows, and the record indicates this, it's a routine practice and procedure. Anytime an ERD complaint or correspondence is made, that correspondence is automatically sent to the complaining witness. That's a matter of course. So to come here before this court and say she was not advised that her complaint was dismissed, it's just completely disingenuous. This is in the record. And what the referees do in these cases is a tragedy to the civil rights cause. There is no fundamental analysis of these cases. Then she brings the other one that Mr. Flesh found that I had made a conversion. There is nothing in this record whereby Mr. Flesh claimed I made a conversion. The conversion finding came from the OLR. Secondly,
well, didn't the conversion finding come from a referee that you used at least $30,450?
I agree with that. Yes. But the point that she raises to you is that the reason I paid the money back was because the commissioner had made a finding of the conversion. What we were trying to do in closing out the estate with my attorneys handling it was to try to clear up and rectify the record. This was pre-OLR investigation. What other misrepresentation she makes to you? She says that there was no discussion of trying to settle or resolve this case short of the PRC. That, too, is a damnable misrepresentation. Before this case was filed, Ms. Stanton wrote several letters outlining the case, and some of those letters are in the files. And it says, Mr. Nunnery has lost his moral compass.
Counsel, I don't think that she said that there was no efforts made on your behalf to settle the case. What I understood her to say is that OLR attorneys are, because of our decisions, precluded from plea bargaining, and once the director has made his decision and recommended what the resulting sanction should be, that they can't really, there isn't anything they can do for you.
I can apologize to say to that, but what the issue was, none of it, do you try to surrender before the fact? That was an attempt before there was even a complaint filed. There was an attempt before the OLR inquiry started to try to resolve this. And my attorneys were turned down. That's the only point that I was making. Then she talks about the Dobbins matter as to why that case was dismissed and administratively closed. It's in the record. The U.S. Housing and Urban Development had offered the Dobbins $5,000 to settle the case. This is in the record. Ms. Dobbins testified she refused that. She wanted more. That's why the case was administratively closed. This case, she wanted to go into federal court and get her Brinks truck. She wanted me to go ahead and pursue this. She wanted her $200,000, whatever was out there. The reason the case proceeded onward, Mr. Goodman, Mr. Collada, the people involved in doing this were federally charged with criminal law. This is in the record. So he files bankruptcy. So when you're suing Mr. Goodman and he's filing bankruptcy and going to prison, what do you have? That's the issue. That never comes up. This is one reason why the case was dismissed.
The Dobbins talk about communication. There was a time they were on the telephonic conference call with the federal judge in this case. They attended deposition hearings. All of that's in the record. But nobody seeks to talk about what I did for this $1,500. The other thing that I want this court, the court to understand, why are you holding the Davis estate money in the first place? What caused you to do this? What I had concluded or believed that I could have filed a claim against the state based upon the management durable power of attorney and health care to seek some compensation. Therefore, I could have been paid for what I had been doing for 3 or 4 years. That's the reason I had been holding the money. We had talked about this with Ms. Sadie Lewis. We had talked about this with Mr. J.B. Davis. There was no intent to deceive and mislead J.B. Davis and Sadie Lewis. They knew the value of the house. They knew the house was being sold. They saw the closing papers. So the amount of money in question, they knew. Did I mishandle this? Yes, I mishandled this.
You still owe the estate $1,300?
Pardon?
Do you still owe the estate $1,300?
That was part of the decision that came out from the referee.
Okay.
And depending on the final disposition of that judge, Gableman, that will be paid forthwith. I just have not done anything on this matter other than the appeal.
And I know the red light is on, but I want to give you the opportunity, Mr. Nunnery, because it's a couple of facts that kind of stick out. There is mention made of an antique sofa and some silver flatware. What is your version of that?
Correct. All of that is still where it is, and I have explained that in the record as well. One final issue, and if I may, Chief Justice.
May, Mr. Nunnery.
Thank you. The referee inquired about my cooperation in these proceedings. He questioned directly Ms. Koke about whether I've been cooperating. All of that is in the record. He asked her about whether this was all intentional. That's in the record. And finally, I listen here of what I call the settling of my prior acts and conduct and even bringing up a March 2009 issue that has not been fully litigated. I think a lot of this stuff is so fundamentally unfair, but I think I have a right to request this of this tribunal. Whatever decision you make, it ought to be at a minimum rationally based. It should not be based on this subjective criterion, but objective criterion. Do not treat me any different than any other lawyer that comes here. And I have said this, and I'm going to get this off my chest. I have been seriously wondering whether there is a desire out here to make a presentation to the minority of black community. We will protect you against this man. But they have yet to come here and show or demonstrate what protection do you have. I have handled 5, 7, or 8 prison death cases. That's in the record. I have done police shootings. I have done employment discrimination up to Kazan. But what they want to do is highlight that I'm stupid. Yes, I did wrong in handling the estate of Davis, but my whole life, the whole taking of my property interests protected under the 5th and 14th Amendment in this frame on allegations and innuendo, and no one has the time, even the referees. And in that process, whether I talk about prima facie case, whatever I did, it was wrong. Thank you.
Mr. Nunnery, on what basis then will the court, if we follow your recommendation, suspend you from 12 to 18 months?
Your Honor, I don't know what the rational, I think the rational basis has to be the totality of the facts in this case, one. Two, whether the draconian suspension in this case is compatible with prior historical precedents. Three, are the matters in this case of such sufficiency to go beyond what the referee has said? I think not. I think when I look at some of the cases and in the totality of it, I just have not seen anything of analogous basis. There is no rational system. And what is, this court independently can decide to do whatever it wants to do as it relates to discipline. That is clear in the mandate. I hear and you see other cases, you read other cases, but I believe this case has never been fully understood and delved in as it relates to employment discrimination. I believe in the prior discipline, and the late Dan Hildebrand, we talked about this. The question, do you believe it's happening to you because of your race? I never go that way. But what I do understand, if anyone looks at these cases and what I did in these cases from a rational point of view and the law, I give, Ms. Dobbins called me and say, hey, I'm about to lose my mortgage. I can't sell this. Can you help me? And I do that, and then I get charged with an allegation. Yeah, I was wrong. You know, you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have helped your client. I am a civil rights lawyer. I'm out here and was out here, as my son said, my daddy, try to help people. And when I did that, I come back and I get all of this. This is, I'll be okay. But all I ask, please review the entire record. Look at the testimony of Ms. Sproul. Look at the testimony of Ms. Blackwood. Look at the testimony as to what they say at heart. Plow into the interplay of Section 42 U.S.C. 1981 and Title VII. There is no appreciation for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Barber, do you have a question? Mr. Nunnery, thank you for coming today and giving your side. We know how difficult this is for you and for the court, too, and for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. We now close the hearing on 07AP 1908D and 06AP 1191D, OLR versus Nunnery. This is the last, as we expected, oral argument of this term. So we are adjourned for oral arguments, and the court will meet in the conference room in 5 minutes.